PR.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, New York State's legislative session is wrapped for the year, but several farm-related bills hang in limbo and federal cuts loom. What does it all mean for young farmers trying to build a future? Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with two local growers about the policies shaping their livelihoods and the challenges they face. Arts funding is shrinking, but Sullivan County isn't staying silent. Coming up, Genevieve Hartnett speaks with Lourdesa Hunt from the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center about fighting for support, restoring local history, and why investing in diverse, community-driven art spaces matters now more than ever. Plus, science stories with Joe Johnson featuring blood-curdling Permian monsters that ruled the Earth before dinosaurs, and the latest edition of Curtain Call after the news.
NPR News in Washington. I'm Corva Coleman. The Republican tax and spending cut bill is back before the House. It narrowly cleared the Senate yesterday after Vice President Vance cast the tie-breaking vote. The changes made in the Senate version must now be taken up in the House. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, Speaker Mike Johnson believes the bill will be approved in the House by Friday, July 4th.
Republicans are united on the main parts of this bill, like making President Trump's 2017 tax cuts permanent and increasing funding for border security. That said, there are still disagreements over how to pay for it all. Some fiscal hawks in the House have expressed concern with parts of the Senate-passed bill, which could be a challenge for House Speaker Mike Johnson, who can only afford to lose a few votes. But he says he's moving the process forward.
You know, I've got to play the cards that are dealt to me, and we're working through that, talking to all members and all caucuses and everybody else. But we remain optimistic we're going to land this plane.
Johnson has called for lawmakers to be back in D.C. to get to work. Elena Moore, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Supreme Court of Wisconsin has overturned a state law on abortion. It dates back to 1849. That had criminalized nearly all abortions. The Wisconsin High Court ruled the state law had been effectively repealed by newer laws passed by the state legislature. The decision means Wisconsin providers can continue offering abortions in that state. President Trump has released about 150 National Guard troops back to the control of California Governor Gavin Newsom. Trump deployed these troops to Los Angeles last month to protect federal buildings during protests. Newsom wants Trump to release all of the troops so they can return to helping California fight wildfires.
Critical that we get our men and women back, the National Guard, to get them back doing the work in partnership with the Conservation Corps and CAL FIRE. To get these projects moving again.
Several brush fires have broken out in California in the past few days. Stocks opened mixed this morning as the parent company of CBS agrees to settle a lawsuit filed by President Trump. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 90 points in early trading.
CBS parent Paramount shares opened higher after the company agreed to pay $16 million to President Trump's future library. Paramount will not apologize for the way 60 Minutes edited an interview with former Vice President Kamala Harris in the run-up to the November election. Trump took issue with that interview. The settlement comes as Paramount is seeking government approval for its sale to Skydance Media. Gasoline prices are falling as Americans get set for a busy 4th of July. AAA reports the average price of regular gas is $3.17 a gallon. That's about a nickel less than a week ago. The Auto Club projects more than 60 million people will take road trips during the holiday weekend. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. A new report is debunking a claim from a Russian official about Russian fighting in Ukraine. A Russian-appointed official had said earlier this week Russian troops had taken over all of the occupied Ukrainian region of Luhansk. The Institute for the Study of War says that is not true and cited Russian military bloggers as the reason. Several areas in Nigeria have no clinical oncologists for cancer treatment. That's even though medical officials report a rise in cancer cases there. NPR's Emmanuel Akinwotu reports the brain drain of medical professionals is a major problem Nigeria's government is struggling to address.
At least 16 of Nigeria's 36 states do not have clinical oncologists, despite a rise in cancer cases, according to the Nigerian Cancer Society. The NCS said it's due to doctors choosing to leave the country for better opportunities, especially in Europe and the US. Last year, Nigeria's health minister, Mohamed Pate, said 16,000 doctors had left the country in the previous 5 to 7 years, and 75,000 nurses and midwives had also left the country over the same period. The poor employment conditions of medical staff in Nigeria have fueled an exodus of medical professionals. The government have promised to improve pay and training conditions and have also imposed restrictions on nurses seeking to work abroad. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
The Trump administration has pulled down a website featuring the most updated information on climate change in the U.S. The administration had already stopped work on the next edition of the National Climate Assessment and fired everybody working on it. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Your Part-Time Controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting. YPTC.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. The New York State legislative session wrapped up last month. On the table were big issues for farmers in the region, like sewage sludge, school bid contracts, and SNAP benefits. The bills that did pass now head to Governor Kathy Hochul to sign, but some notable environmental bills failed to pass in the assembly. Some lawmakers have suggested that the state assembly may come back to session in the fall in response to the proposed federal funding cuts. So what does this mean for New York's young farmers? Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel, co-owners of Finca Ceramos Farm in Calicoon Center, and members of the local Young Farmers Coalition chapters about how state and federal policies could shape the future of farming.
So let's start with the bills that did pass and the bills that did not pass that the local Young Farmers chapters were monitoring this session.
Yeah, sure. I can start with a bill that definitely had some discussion among the young farmers that we're in community with. And it's actually a bill that arose from some discussions that I was able to take part in with the Northeast Organic Farming Association of New York. Some listeners may know Wes Gillingham of Wild Roots Farm and is on the Soil Health Subcommittee with me. And we have these conversations about the spreading of biosolids or sludge on fields. But one of the big risks that this practice involves is the introduction of PFAS or forever chemicals. And they can come into this biosludge from a few different ways, from human waste streams that are mixed into these biosludge applications, and from industrial uses, byproducts like pulp from paper mills, for instance, and chemicals that come out of that, that can be mixed into these sludge applications and have a high level of these PFAS chemicals. And to give you a sense of the scale, we don't have a clear sense of how widespread the practice of spreading this sludge directly on fields is in New York State. We know it happens in certain municipalities more than others, but we do know that major fertilizer and agribusiness companies are using these biosolids in the preparation of things as common as potting soil. If you get your Scott's mix at the Agway or Miracle-Gro, more and more likely it is these days that contains these biosolids. And so the bill that passed in the Senate but has yet to pass in the Assembly in New York State is a moratorium on this practice.
What about other bills that may have been on your radar?
So the Good Food Purchasing Bill was definitely on our radar. I have a background in education. I spent 15 years in schools. And something that we really hope to do as a business in the future is get our food into schools. The Good Food New York Bill was something that we were excited about because it really incentivizes public institutions to be able to spend more money on diverse farms who can provide the kinds of food that we're growing to the kinds of communities we want to serve. We grow a lot of culturally responsive produce and vegetables and herbs, and we want to make sure that the communities that really love those foods are getting those foods in as many places as possible, including in school settings. But right now, public institutions in the state are required to use a bidding process to procure food, and they have to go with the lowest bidder. And that creates a lot of incentive to reduce the price as much as possible, cut corners on labor, cut corners on safety, cut corners on environmental protections, so that you can get your bid in. So right now, for a farm like us, we're a second-year farm. We're really passionate about the community work that we're doing. We really believe in making sure that our labor practices are really solid and that they're sustainable and that our employees are able to do this work for as long as they want to. All of those considerations make it much more challenging for us to participate in any kind of bid process. We are essentially priced out if we want to have the kind of work environment and the kind of pay that makes our work sustainable.
Yeah. What I thought was what was interesting about the Good Food Bill this session was that I believe that it was actually passed through the legislature last year. It headed to Governor Hochul's desk in hopes of being signed, but then the governor actually vetoed it last December. Hochul said that one of the reasons why she decided not to sign it is she said that the way that the bill is written, it would lead to different standards across different jurisdictions, which she alleges would actually make it harder for local growers to secure contracts. I'm curious, like, what you have to say to those concerns. Is that necessarily true?
So I think our understanding of the veto is that it was pretty political. Generally, if the governor is going to veto a bill for principal reasons, she's probably going to do it a little earlier than the very end of December, which is the last moment for her to exercise that veto right. And I think you can look to the Farm Bureau's opposition to this bill to help explain Governor Hochul's veto. Mm. I think that is a Farm Bureau talking point. And frankly, I don't think it really holds water. And this year, I think we're very pleased to see that Senator Hinchey's bill passed with a veto-proof majority in the Senate. So 42 of the senators voted yes when it passed at the end of this session. And so if the Assembly comes back, say, in the fall, they'll have another opportunity to pass this. And if they get a supermajority as well, then it can't be vetoed. And that would be really exciting.
Let's talk some bit about funding. President Trump's quote-unquote big, beautiful bill, it passed through the House of Representatives. It's now with the Senate, and it had, you know, initially included an estimated $230 billion in SNAP cuts over 10 years and would pass a significant amount of those SNAP cuts onto states specifically. I'm curious what some of these cuts that are being considered in the bill, what would that mean actually for the communities that you serve?
Yeah, that's a hard one. When we sat down to prepare for the end of our season last year after the elections, we anticipated this coming. And it was really concerning for us because 30% of our members last year were using SNAP benefits to buy their CSA share. Our goal this year was to have 40%, and our ultimate five-year plan goal is to have 50% of our members using SNAP benefits, because everybody should be able to get quality, culturally responsive food regardless of what their income is. So we knew right away that we needed to start making moves, and we leveraged our community and our sliding scale to try to mitigate the cuts we were anticipating seeing. But it literally takes foods out of people's mouths. We have members who were SNAP members who we haven't heard from at all this season, and we suspect that it's because they don't think that they can afford to pay for a share this year. And that's hard. They were people we were seeing every single week, who we have relationships with, who we now don't have that connection point with anymore. I mean, food is medicine. We're talking about not just taking food out of people's mouths. We're talking about really impacting people's health.
Well, oh my goodness. So you're already seeing people who receive SNAP benefits or that you've been in community with already kind of pull back from the way they interact with you.
Yeah. I mean, they were not receiving enough by any means already when they were receiving their benefits. And I think everyone has been sort of wary that this was a possibility. And so, you know, a CSA is a commitment. It's a commitment for the season. And then I think there are people who don't want to make a commitment that they don't feel like they can fulfill at the start of the season if there's a chance that they're going to lose their benefits midway through.
You know, we talked about how this would impact the communities you serve. What about farmers themselves? How would these proposed cuts specifically impact young farmers and farm owners?
I think what we're seeing among the farming community especially with young farmers, there are a lot of us who do this kind of more mission-aligned food access work. And a lot of us have been hit really hard by, even before the SNAP cuts that are looming large right now, cuts to food access programs like the Local Food Purchasing Assistance Program, LFPA, that the USDA was supposed to administer in a second tranche this summer, that is better known in New York as the New York Food for New York Families program. It gets passed through the state and administered as under that name. And it allows food banks and food pantries to purchase our food directly using these funds and get it to their clients. And it's some of the best food that they ever get access to. We hear that time and time again. And, you know, as Brenda said, it's a right to have access to this kind of nutrient-dense, preferably organically grown produce. And so these cuts are really impacting the way that we do business. We are trying to work with our local food pantry and food relief partners to help them find additional funding. I mean, philanthropy is really stretched tight right now. The Local Food for Schools program is another federal program that has been cut that a lot of farms were relying on to get food into schools. You know, you had food procurement managers in schools really grooving on getting access to our produce and getting it on the plate for kids of all ages. And to have that momentum sort of cut out from under us is a real shock, and it's a real blow. And I think as young farmers, we're trying to figure out what the strategy is in terms of advocating for the return of this funding and hopefully its increase, and figuring out where other sources of funding can be identified.
There's a lot that is up in the air right now, and I'm curious, what are you keeping an eye out for these next few months?
We're in a very tricky position. I think Brenda described it accurately in a conversation we had a little while ago as between a rock and a hard place. The feds are making good on these threats to massively cut funding, not just SNAP, but also Medicaid, which, you know, Brenda and I both rely on for our healthcare as young farmers. And the state has to figure out how to respond. I think one of the reasons that this legislative session felt so unfinished is because I think most legislators understand it to be so unfinished. You know, I worked in a state legislator's office for about 4 years myself, and I had never seen a session look quite like this one. And the time that I was working in government was during COVID. So that tells you something about the level of uncertainty that I think state lawmakers are facing down right now. And in conversations that we've had with state lawmakers, that we as advocates have had, that's become clear. They fully anticipate coming back to session in the fall once the dust has settled on the federal legislation and the impact of the cuts that we saw the administration make in the first 100 days. And they're going to have some tough questions. How hard can they push their federal colleagues to make good on the funding that was guaranteed and has been cut out from under them versus how much do they then need to dip into the New York Rainy Day Fund, which is about $33 billion. Mm. It's not chump change. And I think the calculus for legislators is how much suffering can the people of New York endure before New York just coughs up the money for New Yorkers?
Yeah, we're also really hopeful that they will, as they sort of grapple with this rock and a hard place that they're in, I hope that they will continue to talk to the community that they serve and really stay in touch with their partners in those communities to understand exactly sort of where the breaking points are for people. Because it's one thing to know the technical impact when you're up in Albany and you're on the floor arguing, but it's another thing to deal with the day-to-day reality. And so making sure that they're staying in touch with their communities, making sure that they're staying in touch with local advocates, making sure that they're really aware of the impact that these cuts are having as they sort of negotiate with the feds is going to be really important.
I've been chatting with Brenda Gonzalez and Chris Nickel from Finca Seremos Farm. Brenda and Chris, thank you so much for chatting today.
Thank you, Kim.
And thanks to Kimberly Izar for that report. We'll take a break, and when we come back, arts funding is shrinking, but some Sullivan County organizations aren't staying silent. We'll learn more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the new exotic sounds of Skip Heller and the Voodoo Five, the Royal Samoans, and A Mambo in 3D by Tito Puente. I'm Darryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Hey, Kimberly Izar here of Farm and Country. Big changes are coming for young farmers. Some good, some not so much. This week on Farm and Country, we're at Finca Seremos Farm in Calicoon Center, talking sewage sludge, school contracts, and SNAP. Policy issues that have real-life impacts. Plus, Julia Kim explores food justice with the Catskills Agrarian Alliance. All of that and more this week on Farming Country, Saturday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
Support comes from Sullivan Allies Leading Together, committed to ensuring the safety of our community. Protect those most important by keeping medications in a secure space. Be a part of the solution. More at saltcares.com.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. As arts funding faces cutbacks across the country, local organizations in Sullivan County, like the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, are speaking out about what's at stake. HPAC is calling on state and regional funders to recognize the vital role the arts play in preserving cultural heritage, boosting tourism, and fostering inclusive community spaces. Radio Catskill's Genevieve Hartnett sat down with Lourdesa Hunt, Director of Development at HPAC, to talk about the organization's advocacy efforts, its new restoration of the historic O&W Luzon Station, and why investing in the arts, especially in smaller, diverse spaces, matters now more than ever.
So at the legislative meeting a couple weeks ago, you spoke about how Sullivan County is not moving fast enough to address the decrease in federal funding towards arts organizations. How does that specifically impact the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, and how does that change your operations? What does that look like?
Well, we are at a standpoint in our operations where it is pay employees or put out programming for the community. Mm-hmm. And that's a really hard spot to be in, because so much of what we pride ourselves on there is to be able to put this accessible programming out for the community. Arts and culture isn't always about just going to a fully formed play or a fully formed musical or a performance. It's often about putting that in someone's hands and creating that spark at a smaller level. So it's not something that we want to do, and we are making our way through. But to your point, there are a lot of national grants that are no longer available to arts organizations. The NEA, they're pulling those grants, things that have been awarded or, you know, contract, they're pulling those away. Yeah. Just simply based on if your programming promotes diversity, equity, and inclusion, then you're no longer applicable for those funds. And then on top of that, so there is that kind of attack on that community or that mission. If you're arts organization, many arts organizations, that is the mission, because as artists, that's where we found our home. We create art to address those needs, and we celebrate them there. And that's how it's always been historically. It's just kind of been that platform, that mouthpiece, that voice for the underserved. So combine that also with just general federal uncertainty that is then trickling down into your state and then into your county and into your towns and villages.
How much prior to the Trump administration returning to DC, I mean, how much did the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center rely on grants from the National Endowment of the Arts?
I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but it was a pretty large chunk prior to me coming on. And I am especially challenged as I came into the organization just in August. I was ready to hit the ground running with all of these avenues and platforms that suddenly come November, come January, all those pedestals were kind of taken away.
A lot of people assume that arts organizations in states like New York that have robust fine and performing arts scenes, that they'll be fine. But can you share some of the reality of running a performing arts center in a more rural area like Sullivan County? And, you know, especially now, what does that look like?
Oh, my. Well, the reality of running a performing arts center in general is that artists deserve to be paid. Our big push is always to make sure that we can pay those artists and make sure that they are paid. But to your point, it's very difficult in a rural landscape to create, if you're making a ticketed event, to make sure that that ticket price is enough to keep your doors open, but also pay those artists that wage that they deserve creating the pieces that they create. It's also a challenge in finding the programming that's going to speak to, a diverse community, because there are so many different groups in what they might want to see or what they might want to experience. So it's really kind of a balancing act to make sure that you are, putting out impactful programming while also putting out something that reaches to the community to bring them in. So it's always kind of a balancing act. The struggle with funding, especially in our rural community, is that, and it's the reason that we push so hard for support, not just in grant funding from our community partners like the Visitors Association and the legislature, is that we pride ourselves on making sure that our programming is as low cost or free wherever possible to ensure that even in an economic downturn, that the arts don't become something that is no longer accessible for everyone. There's no need to hide it from the community that we thrive because you support us. And we're so thankful for every one of our donors, every one of our guests who come and visit or take part in our programs. We are thankful for each and every one of you.
The performing arts are integral to the history of and attraction to the Catskills and Sullivan County. In your opinion, having worked with the Visitors Association and now with the Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, do you feel like the area's funding and tourism focus has drifted away from fostering its cultural legacy? Do you feel like there could be more attention to it?
I actually do think that there should be more focus on it at a more granular level. So there is a big focus on larger venues, but there are so many smaller groups and venues and things that are coming up. And being that our landscape once was that big, diverse, every resort had its own entertainment, yeah. Every resort had its own section. Those communities are really trying to rebuild on that now. Mm. And it feels like the landscape of Sullivan County, while they are pushing the bigger venues, a lot of it is really focusing on wellness versus arts and culture. Mm. And I think it's a big mistake. That's what people came here for. And wellness was a big part of it, but a lot of it was the entertainment that was offered. And we had some big entertainers come through here. I know that they are also trying to walk that fine line of finding what will draw people to the area. But we need to decide what's going to make people stay in the area or want to come back to the area. And I think arts and culture is what's going to do that.
Hurleyville Performing Arts Center, it has a very wide and diverse performance lineup. As we had discussed, the Trump administration has made it very clear that they will be eliminating funding for projects in the arts that fall outside of their priorities. Has your organization been directly impacted by these guidelines, whether at the federal, state, or local level?
Well, there are federal programs that we can no longer apply for unless we were to do some reconfiguration of our mission, which is directly related to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And it's not something that we're willing to do. Thankfully, New York State does have a very robust grant programs. Those are now opening up again. So we were able to apply for those. Even at county levels, there's some funding within the county that has been, frozen for the time being for new applicants, which of course, there, with the uncertainty, there's going to be a lot of new applicants because those avenues have closed. I will say our legislators have been really supportive in listening to my concerns. The Visitors Association was very supportive in listening to my concerns as I voiced them at the legislature and urged them to not forget that Sullivan County is built on small business, and small business won't survive without support, and visitors won't come here without things to do.
Is there anything that you would like to let people know that we didn't discuss in the interview today, or would you like to talk about any events at Hurleyville Performing Arts Center that are upcoming?
One of the big things, and again, the reason for our push is our programming space. We have outgrown our programming space. So one of the things that we have taken on this year, it's a very big venture, is we are restoring the historic ONW Luzon Station that is in Hurleyville. It's directly adjacent to the Performing Arts Center. It has been out of use since 1957 when the railroad kind of left. It's been owned by the same family who has generously allowed us to acquire the space, and we will be renovating it to be as historically accurate as it can be, but to be another programming space and event space for the community so that we can hold concurrent programming. So we are accepting donations on that. We are doing a capital campaign. We just launched it. We will be installing a community mural composed of over 500 tiles collectively, but there are 350 4x4 tiles that you can purchase on our website, and you will get your own custom paint palette to fit into that master mural. You can paint whatever you like. You do not need to be an artist. You can put a peace sign. You can sign your name as long as it's in the colors, which is such a beautiful tribute to the diverse landscape that we have, because it will come together to form one picture. And at the end of the day, all of these communities of our county come together to make the landscape that we have. And next month, we will have our Sullivan County Music Festival, and that's happening on July 19th from 12 to 4.
Thank you so much for joining us. And we've been talking with Lourdesa Hunt. She is the Director of Development at Hurleyville Performing Arts Center. In Liberty, I'm Genevieve Hartnett for Radio Catskill.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, dragonflies the size of ducks, a camera the size of a car watching the stars, and a mysterious radio burst from a 1960s satellite. This week's science stories are stranger than fiction. Our resident science guy, Joe Johnson, tells us all about it next. This is Radio Chatskill.
On the TED Radio Hour, online shopper Aparna Mehta used to get a lot of packages delivered to her door.
Oh, per week? 12, 15?
Whoa!
Sorry, but I didn't think I was doing anything wrong. Look, the store is making it possible for me to order as many as I want and return back what I don't want.
Shopping and the state of fashion. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Friday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
On the next Jazz Night in America, we'll head to the Newport Jazz Festival to dig a set from an artist whose music is as sunny as the weather, guitarist Corey Wong. That's next time on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride. Join me for Jazz Night in America, Sunday at 8, here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. From cutting-edge space observatories and mysterious radio signals to the blood-curdling Permian monsters that ruled the Earth before dinosaurs, our resident science guy Joe Johnson is here with a whirlwind tour through time and space, literally.
Now, this was an article on the BBC online platform, and what came before the dinosaurs was the Permian period. The dinosaurs lived during the Mesozoic era that was made up of the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous periods. It ended, of course, with the asteroid strike that caused a mass extinction. Before that was the Paleozoic era, though, and the Paleozoic had many, many periods to it, but it ended with the Permian period, which went from about 251 million years ago to about 299 million years ago. Now, this was the time of Pangaea, when all the continents were together. You may remember it from Earth Science class. Think jungles with freshwater lakes, swamps, and inland seas on the edges, but the middle of Pangaea was basically a big wasteland. It was a big desert. Now, this was a time of extremes. It actually began, the Permian period began with the Ice Age, and it ended with the largest mass extinction known to science.
What happened here?
Well, Permian was very, very different from today. First of all, no flowering plants. Angiosperms had not evolved yet. They would not evolve for another 100 million years. Plants were ferns and horsetails and early sorts of gymnosperms like pine trees and ginkgos. But this was a time when there was a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, about 30% compared to 21% today. This is because it followed the Carboniferous period, which was just the earth baked and it had gigantic forests and just released a tremendous amount of oxygen into the air. There were dragonflies the size of ducks flying around during the part of the Permian period.
Yeah, one of the researchers in this article from the BBC says there were many weird and wacky creatures.
Yeah. The dominant land species were called the synapsids. These were the first four-legged, successful four-legged land animals. Amphibians have four legs, but they mostly stay in the water or partially in the water. These synapsids had diverged from the reptiles, which are called the sauropsids, during the Permian period. So this is a different branch that had branched off from the reptiles. This is a lot of, there were a lot of weird critters. Dimetrodon is the one that we all think of. It had that large spiny sail on its back that they thought, they had a lot of theories about what that was for. Some people thought it was for cooling. Some people thought it was for fighting. But it looks like it's maybe courtship and dominance. They kind of looked at all the possibilities. It was a really voracious predator. Think a mouthful of steak knives. It was about 10 to 12 feet long and weighed about 500 pounds. And it had a set of teeth that you wouldn't believe.
Wow. So there were also a lot of crazy shark-like fish in the oceans with serrated circular saws attached to their mouths.
Absolutely.
This sounds like something out of a dream sequence or something.
It was a scary time. I wouldn't want to go back in time to this. The apex predator of the time was this guy called the Antiosaurus. He was about 20 foot long and looked like a overly muscled frog. He weighed about 1,000 pounds. He was very muscular, fast, huge jaw muscles and skulls for crushing prey. He was the apex predator. There were large herds of herbivores, the cynodonts and periosaurs, but they all died at the end of the Permian. And this was a mass extinction. This, in fact, was the largest mass extinction known to science.
This whole period just sounds kind of crazy.
Yeah, like I said, it was extremes. 95% of the marine organisms, stuff that was in the ocean, went extinct. And about 70% of the terrestrial organisms went extinct. This, they think it was caused by massive volcanism. In what is now Siberia, there's this giant chunk of basalt that dates from this area that comes from volcanoes. And they think that the volcanism ignited coal beds that had been laid down during the Carboniferous period, which came before the Permian, and basically burned these coal beds for millions of years and released so much carbon dioxide into the air that the earth heated up by about 10 degrees Celsius.
Are there any ancestral traces of these synapsid predators that are still with us today?
There are, and you'll be surprised. The surviving reptiles from the mass extinction, of course, evolved into the dinosaurs and reptiles and birds that we know today. The surviving synapsids evolved into mammals.
Oh, wow.
Which is us. So we have distant cousins back in the Permian period.
I didn't think we'd be tracing ourselves back to the people with the giant mouthfuls of circular saw teeth.
Yeah.
But wow, that's crazy. Yeah. All right, let's move to space. We're talking about the Vera C. Rubin Observatory's first close-up image. Let's talk about that.
It was everywhere in the news. This was the release of the first set of images from the Vera Rubin Observatory. This is in the Chilean Andes Mountains at about 9,000 feet, and it's observing the southern hemisphere skies. It's a international effort led by the U.S. and Stanford University, and the images are amazing. If you go look them up online, and I would really encourage you to do that.
I have one in front of me right now. Yeah. They're stunning and so vibrant. The pinks and the blues.
Look at it in the highest resolution you can find. These things have such high resolution that you can zoom in and zoom in and zoom in and zoom in and just keep seeing new stuff. They're amazingly detailed. They were taken by the most powerful digital camera, the largest camera ever built. In fact, it was built by the U.S. Department of Energy. This thing is the size of a small car. And it's 3,200 megapixels. And I don't know a lot about that, but I know that's pretty big. The light comes from an 8.4 meter, that's almost 28 feet across, mirror that collects that much light and focuses it onto a smaller mirror, which bounces it off a smaller mirror and then into the camera. The camera works in mostly invisible light, but it'll go from the near infrared to the near UV. And here's the cool part. It's going to photograph the entire southern hemisphere sky every 3 days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So we're going to get some really vivid images.
Yeah. And here's the really cool part. Why are they going to do this? Well, they're hoping to create like basically a time-lapse movie of the sky and then use artificial intelligence to look for changes. So every 3 days, it's going to generate a new set of images, and it will see out there in deep, deep space and other galaxies, you know, what has changed. Was there a supernova? Was there, what happened?
It's reported that this decade-long survey will generate more data in 1 year than mm-hmm. all prior optical astronomy combined.
Yeah.
So I'm expecting we're going to see some new stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's going to generate about 5 petabytes of data per year. That's 5,000 terabytes. In fact, they're building a special facility in Scotland just to house and manage the data. It's just an incredible amount of data they're going to be looking at. Now, there's 4 goals for this observatory. One, they want to map the solar system, because we think we know what's out there, but in the first 10 hours, they discovered more than 2,000 unknown asteroids.
Just within the first couple of hours?
Within the first couple of hours. And everybody keeps talking about Planet Nine. If there's Planet Nine out there, this will find it.
Planet Nine meaning life on another planet.
No.
What's Planet Nine?
Well, Planet Nine, some people have theorized that there's a planet out there beyond Pluto, something large, like as big as the Earth or larger, which would qualify as an actual planet. You know, Pluto was demoted to dwarf planet a while ago. And so they think there might be a ninth planet out there. There's a lot of controversy in astronomy about that. But other goals, they're looking for transient events, supernova, variable stars, near-Earth objects, and they have discovered a couple of new near-Earth objects. They want to understand the formation of the Milky Way, because we want to know where a galaxy came from. How did it happen? And last but not least, and certainly not least, it's who it was named for, was understanding dark matter. Now, Vera Rubin, observatory is named for, she was an astronomer who studied the rotation of galaxies, and she observed that stars farther outwards in a galaxy that we would expect to go slower are actually moving at the same speed as stars closer into the galaxy, into the center of the galaxy. And the only way they can do that is if there's a lot more gravity, and the only way they can have that much more gravity is to have more matter. But we can't see that matter, and that's why it's called dark matter. And that's the term they've put on it.
Dark matter.
Dark matter, yes.
Let's stay in the dark reaches of space here with another story. A powerful and mysterious blast of radio waves. Mm-hmm. Astronomers thought was from a fast radio burst far beyond the limits of the Milky Way, but it turned out to be something else, surprising.
Yeah, it turned out to be a lot closer to home than that. This is from a June pre-publication release from scientists at Cornell University. First of all, a little background. Fast radio bursts were first detected in 2007, and since then about 1,000 have been recorded. Many of them are milliseconds in length, some shorter, some longer, some actually repeat. But some can release as much energy as the sun releases in a month. So they're incredibly powerful. They come from galaxies about 1 billion light years away, although there has been one discovered in our own galaxy, in the Milky Way. One was detected. They're thought to come from neutron stars. But this burst was different. It happened on June 13th, 2024, and it was detected by the Australian Square Kilometer Array Pathfinder, basically a giant telescope, a giant radio telescope, and it lasted for about 30 nanoseconds, or about 30 billionths of a second. Now, when they went to trace the source, they had to do some math because it was a lot closer than they're used to. It was actually only about 4,500 kilometers from the Earth. The source was identified as the Relay 2 communication satellite that had been launched in 1964 and was basically dead in space and space junk since 1967 for like almost 50 years. Wow. It's crazy. About the size of a dishwasher, it was a communication satellite. I mean, it was early in the technology, so it didn't last too long. Now, why would this satellite all of a sudden create this gigantic, powerful, pretty powerful radio burst?
Life in space?
Life in space? No.
Okay.
There's two theories. Collisions with a micrometeor moving at such high speeds that all the kinetic energy was spent and created a plasma burst. It created, it knocked a hole in the satellite and made plasma. I imagine that they'll see if the orbit has changed. The more popular theory is that it was basically an electrostatic discharge, a big static shock. As these satellites move through space, they go through different areas of geomagnetic strength, and they can accumulate a charge on them. And what they think is that this thing accumulated such a charge that basically a giant spark jumped off it and created, I don't know if you've been around like a sparking motor in a radio, but it creates a lot of static. And it creates a lot of radio noise. And they think that that's their most popular theory right now.
So how did this Relay 2 satellite for 58 years sort of fool scientists and astronomers for a little bit?
Well, they couldn't believe that it was so close to the Earth. They had to go back and recheck their math. In fact, they did several times until they figured out that this is the only thing it could come from.
Are there other kinds of fast radio bursts that are like pseudo bursts as well out there?
They have detected some radio static coming from space, and they think that they may have been just smaller static sparks coming off satellites.
The dark reaches of space. Yeah, there's always something out there, except for life yet. Science Stories with Joe Johnson.
Keep up hope.
One day you're going to come in here and tell me that. Science Stories with Joe Johnson. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest episode of Curtain Call, our local theater podcast with Tom Candela. He's here after this. It's Radio Chatskill.
We're reaching out to you to keep Radio Catskill thriving. Yes, we've got quality news from around the world, but Radio Catskill is also about so much more. We connect you with your neighbors, their stories, what's happening in the community, and that local flavor you just can't get anywhere else. Help us provide the local news, culture, and connections folks rely on. Give now at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, where our local theater podcast is Curtain Call with Tom Candela, focusing on the theater scene in the region. He's here to tell us about the latest episode. And this one, you've got a relatively new, I guess, theater from Orange County. Tell us about that one, Greenwood Lake.
Yes. You know, Tim, the more I do this show, the more I learn just how much theater, great theater, there is in our community. And I discovered this professional equity company that's out in Greenwood Lake by accident, by reading the magazine Canvas. And I contacted them, and I spoke with their Catherine Weatherford and Mary McKinley. They are the co-artistic directors of the company, and they really have some really innovative and wonderful productions that they do out there, from everything from their Shakespeare in the Park to some of their Christmas shows and pageants that they have in an old church in the Warwick Historical Society.
Yeah, the old school Baptist meeting house there in Warwick.
It's really, really incredible. And they have this new show coming up in September called Nevermore, The Imaginary Life and Mysterious Death of Edgar Allan Poe. It's a musical, believe it or not. You know,
and of course it is.
It's coming up in September. And, you know, it was really, really a great conversation. And then towards the end of this segment, I also went out to the Forestburg Playhouse a couple of weeks ago and saw their show, Boeing, hysterical. And I got to interview a couple of the audience members there. So that's all there in the full segment.
All right, let's take a listen. It's an excerpt from Curtain Call, the local theater podcast here at Radio Catskill, from our friend here, Tom Candela.
Lots of fun. Today, we're heading into the Hudson Valley to shine the spotlight on a gem of a company, Greenwood Lake Theater. Born out of a deep passion for storytelling and community, this equity professional theater in Orange County, New York, brings together classic tales and fresh voices through powerful performances, education, and artistic collaboration. Joining us today are Greenwood Lake Theater's co-artistic directors, Catherine Weatherford, who prefers to be called Katie, and Mary McKinley. Ladies, I want to welcome you both to Curtain Call.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
It's a pleasure. So I want to start at the very beginning. What inspired both of you to form this theater company?
Well, so we both were New York City transplants who found our way out to this little community in the Hudson Valley, Greenwood Lake, which is a part of the town of Warwick. And we actually came out there, I think, within 1 year of each other.
Yes.
And it's a pretty small town, but somehow we hadn't met each other yet. And I was at a point for me personally where I had been working in the industry for over 10 years, but I think I was just reaching a point where I wasn't feeling all that fulfilled by the work I was doing. And I was just looking for what I could do next that might make me happier. And so I was out on my kayak on Greenwood Lake, and I was paddling by our town beach, which has a small raised platform stage. And I was like, okay, maybe that's something. And so I went home, and because it's a small town, I emailed the mayor of the village of Greenwood Lake. I think there should be a theater company in Greenwood Lake, and we should perform at the town beach. What do you say? Said, yes, that sounds great. He said, but there's this other lady in Greenwood Lake. She also does theater. I'd like for you two to meet and see if you can work together. And I'm going to be honest, I kind of felt like I was being set up on a theater play date. And I was kind of annoyed. But anyway, I emailed Mary and we met up for coffee in Midtown Manhattan.
And that was the luckiest day of your life.
Yes, it was.
So how did you come to Greenwood Lake area?
My mom had gotten really sick in 2015 and I bought a house out in Greenwood Lake. And I had been down to the town beach, very similar to Katie's story. And I wanted to do an annual Shakes by the Lake. And I thought it was a brilliant idea. And I messaged the mayor, very similar story. And he was like, there's this other lady who wants to do it too. It was really great to get to know Katie. And we've been friends ever since and collaborators ever since.
I think one of the things that's worked really well and one of the things I definitely got from that first conversation is that we just happen to be very aligned on what we prioritize for theater.
I had done more producing at the time, so it made for a really nice pairing. So as we got to know each other, I realized that we were aligned, and that was so important. And that's, I think, why we've been so successful and we're still doing it.
That's great.
3 years into that, we were pretty desperate to change it up and figure out what we could do. And we got just a random email from the executive director of the Warwick Valley Historic Society, a wonderful woman named Nora Gervich. And she emailed us and said, I was on your website and I wanted to know, is there any way we can help each other? And it just so happened that that year was going to be the first year we did a production of A Christmas Carol. And we see this beautiful church from 1810, and it's cool, and it's got this upper balcony, and it's got this raised pulpit, and all these fun nooks and crannies. So that was our first indoor home.
Yeah.
Was there with the Historic Society. And that actually, that partnership with the Historic Society is the only thing that kept us able to produce during the pandemic.
You've worked on everything from Into the Woods, Back to the Future, a musical review, and then you've done these great Shakespeare pieces. So how do you decide which shows you're going to choose and which direction you're going in a given season?
One word, money.
I mean, I wish that wasn't the answer, but it honestly is. It's, theater is so expensive to produce, and professional theater is very expensive to produce. I mean, any given production, 75% of the cost of the show is paying the humans to be there to do the show.
Yeah.
And that does mean for us, we tend to look these days towards smaller cast shows.
So especially after the pandemic, because obviously donations dropped, we started going, okay, how can we do more with less money? Then we started to get more in plays around that time, and they were very successful. So yeah, I was like, well, let's try this play.
So it's funny because some of the decisions we've had to make for survival have been decisions that have led us in some really interesting artistic directions.
But it makes you think outside of the box.
It does. You know? And I think now that we've kind of like locked into a little bit more of this is how we make decisions, we've also started to try to think, is there a little something for everyone? We want to make sure that for anybody who might be thinking, yeah, I'd like to go to a show, that there might be something in our season they'd be interested in.
Of course. It's very important for us that it's the art and the work that stands out, and not that just we're serving our own selves. We're really serving the mission and trying to put out the best of the work that we can.
So let's talk about Nevermore. Yeah. It's your next production coming up. Tell us more about it.
Its official full title is Nevermore, The Imaginary Life and Mysterious Death of Edgar Allan Poe. We decided if we were going to do something in this kind of fall slot, which the show is going to be the last 2 weekends in September, that we should do something geared towards fall, spooky season. It has a very contemporary feel, but is very true to Poe's text in a lot of places.
And something's not done that often.
It's not.
Yeah. Smaller cast. It fits with
seven people. And I think it's something that also just really spoke to us. I think it's very cool. The premise of Nevermore is a traveling troupe of players meets Edgar Allan Poe on a steamer ship.
Okay.
And so this company of six people becomes every single person Poe has ever interacted with. And the story kind of dives into what things that happened to him inspired some of the most famous poems, what inspired The Raven, what inspired Annabelle Lee.
Well, tell us, when is that coming up?
So we will be the last 2 weekends in September. So September 20th and 21st.
and 28th, 29th. And that is the other thing we'll have coming up, actually before Nevermore,
correct,
is we'll have two Shakespeare's.
The Shakespeare plays, that's going to be coming up in August,
yes,
right?
August 2nd and 3rd will be
12th night
and Comedy of Errors. And that will be at the theater at Mountain Lake Park at our home base. And then Nevermore will be in September. It will be September 20th and 21st and then 28th and 29th.
Okay. All right. And where do they get tickets?
On our website, greenwoodlaketheater.org.
So once again, ladies, thank you. Katie and Mary, thanks for being on Curtain Call.
Thank you
so much.
And what a joy it was to hear from Katie and Mary and to learn all about the exciting things happening at the Greenwood Lake Theater. From Poe's dark imagination to nurturing tomorrow's performers, their work is a true testament to the power of community-centered storytelling. But now it's time to switch gears and locations, if you will. I'm going to zip on over to Forsberg Playhouse. I went a couple of weekends ago to see the opening of their 2025 main stage season. That show was Boeing. It's a classic farce filled with turbulence and timing and great physical slapstick and a whole lot of laughter. So while the actors were having the audience in stitches, I was able to catch up with two very enthusiastic ladies who were sitting right in front of me, and I spoke with them during intermission. So buckle your seatbelts. It is time for the Roving Thespian. We're sitting here with two lovely ladies who've been watching Boeing and having a great time. What is your name, miss?
Gladys Terrell.
And your name?
It's Paula Lewis.
Paula Lewis. Is this your first time, Paula, at the Forsberg?
Yes, it is, and it won't be my last.
That is a great, great review right then and there. Right.
I don't know how I missed it this long, but that's going to change.
Well, I have to confess, this is my first time here as well.
Oh,
yes,
good.
So we're both Forsberg Theater virgins, if you will. And how about yourself?
I've been here once before in the theater. No, twice before. I seen Birdcage, and I can't remember what the other one was.
Birdcage, is that the La Cage aux Folles? I think that's what that became eventually.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So what do you think of this show?
I love it.
Lots of fun, isn't it?
It's funny. It's so funny. I'm laughing and crying at the same time.
It's very easy to happen.
It's hysterical, and what people don't realize is the amount of work that goes into this. It's not like a movie where you can cut pieces out. They have to remember everything at the right time.
It's a very physical show as well.
Yes, and the cabaret was fantastic.
Oh, you went to the cabaret before the show. Who did you see sing?
Eric Rodriguez. Yeah.
Did you have a dinner too?
Yes, I did. We did, and it was fantastic. The food is delicious.
It's great.
Do you plan on coming to another show this season?
I would like to, yes. And I'd also like to comment on the service. It was excellent with the food and the seating. Any questions we had, they had the answers. So they get a 10 from me.
That is a great review. They're going to be very pleased to hear that. So great. And will you be back?
If I can come, I will, because I'm not too far away.
I want to thank both you ladies for being on Curtain Call. I want to thank you both for your comments.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. And let's talk again after the show, because we got a whole other act. Let's see how it goes. All right. Thank you. Oh, here comes the lights. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies.
That is Tom Candela with his podcast, Curtain Call, focusing on local theater. You can hear the full episode and previous episodes at our website, wjffradio.org. They normally drop on Fridays, but because of the holiday, there's a new one there right now. Go to wjffradio.org. While you're there, please consider making a donation. Our public media here and across the country, in fact, under attack like never before. Your financial support is essential in providing our vital service to our community. Stand with us, help us, and donate now. Our summer fund drive officially begins on Monday, but you can donate immediately at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week on This American Life, Mahmoud Khalil was in detention for more than 3 months because the Trump administration said he engaged in anti-Semitic activity in Columbia University protests. We talked to him about the Shabbat and Passover services he's been to with his Jewish friends, and playing a Jewish character in a middle school play in a Palestinian refugee camp. The real Mahmoud, this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast, clouds giving way to some sun. Less humid this afternoon, a high of 80. Clear and low 57 tonight. Tomorrow, we might see a heavy thunderstorm in the afternoon or early evening. Otherwise, partly sunny, 77. And a nice holiday weekend, Friday, sunny, less humid, 75. Saturday, 81, partly cloudy, and 85 Sunday, sun peeking through some high clouds, according to the National Weather Service. This is WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at WJFFradio.org. Radio Catskill. It's a